Welcome back. Don will be joining us in just a minute. So I will just go ahead and mention that this book, Awakening the Kind Heart, by Kathleen McDonald, that he has been reading from and referring to, is available in our bookstore. I don't have a lot of experience with it, but even from what we've heard here, it's lovely. So, and if anybody needs somebody to check them out in the bookstore, I am able to do that. I'm not standing there at the bookstore, but if you need help in the bookstore, please feel free to ask me. I can help you.
So I think what we'll do is we'll just do our meditation on love, immeasurable love. Again, you might have handy that single sheet, the one that has the verse that we're going to recite when we get to the place where we're cultivating immeasurable love, kind of love for all sentient beings. Oh, you know what I didn't do? I didn't cover the kindness of others. Let's do the meditation first, and then I'll talk about that. So what we're going to do is, when we get to the second step, we're going to first cultivate love for ourselves, and then secondly, cultivating love for, we'll just work with friends. But that's kind of an easy place to start. After we work with ourselves and we work with those people that we're already quite close to, or animals that we're quite close to, you can take your pick there when we talk about friends or dear beings. And then for the third step, we'll generate this out for all sentient beings. And then I'll come back around and talk a little bit about the kindness of others so that we can understand some of the rationale for extending kindness beyond just our friends to those people who are strangers as well as to those who are difficult, and cover a little bit of that. So let's just find a good meditation posture. Again, making sure that the back is straight. And when I say that, that doesn't mean that you overly straighten the back like you're standing at attention when you were, you know, in grade school or something. It means that you just find that place where the spine is naturally upright, where hopefully you don't need to use a lot of tension in any of the muscles in the lower back to hold you in that position. You just have this sort of natural uprightness to the body. And the head is on top of the spine. You can tilt it forward very slightly. And you can close your eyes if you wish. Sometimes it's useful to do that. But also in the tradition, we emphasize keeping the eyelids slightly open. And if that's comfortable for you, it's helpful to do that, especially after we just ate lunch, so the mind might be a little tired because of digesting the food from lunch. So check the rest of your posture. Make sure that you're in a comfortable position, with the body somewhat relaxed. And then, as usual, we're going to do just a few minutes of focusing on the breath, and then we'll set our motivation and go right into this meditation on immeasurable love. So do whatever meditation you find appropriate for working with the breath. If you don't have one that you already use, as I mentioned earlier, you can tune into that sensation at the tip of the nose, where you feel the air coming in through the nostrils and then going back out through the nostrils, and just try to stay focused on that as best as you can. When the mind wanders, then gently bring the mind back to the breath. So I'll ring the chime, and then we'll do a few minutes in silence and continue with the guided meditation. So before we begin the meditation on loving kindness, just refresh your motivation of bodhicitta, recognizing that while the main goal is to be a benefit to all sentient beings, in order to accomplish that, we have to work on ourselves. And in particular, we have to develop these qualities that we're working on this weekend. So we're going to meditate on loving kindness so that we can eventually have this to this limitless degree, this immeasurable degree, being able to hold all beings as the object of that thought. And in this way, be able to create the causes and conditions for us to eventually achieve that state of perfect Buddhahood, where we will be able to enact that fully, be fully attentive to the needs of others, helping every one of them to find happiness and the causes of happiness. And think that it's for this reason that you're going to do this meditation as well as engage in this afternoon's teachings. So again, this will be in three parts, and we're going to start with the first part where we cultivate loving kindness towards ourselves. This is an important step, and sometimes people find this to be even the most difficult step, is to work with generating this thought aimed at ourselves. And first, just consider how you are exactly the same as all beings in the simple desire to be happy, to have the causes of happiness. There's no difference between yourself and others in that fundamental way. And then we'll begin to generate this attitude of loving kindness towards ourselves with that understanding that we're just like others in that simple desire. And begin by accepting the reality that each of us has faults, shortcomings, but we need to accept ourselves as we are, to be able to embrace ourselves with whatever imperfections as well as whatever qualities we have. We're going to have that kind of embracing of ourselves within the space of wherever we're at. We know we're not perfect, but we're still very worthy, very deserving of love, of this desire to be happy. And as part of this, we can acknowledge that we do have the potential to cultivate even deeper qualities. We do have the potential to remove our negative tendencies. We can change. We can grow. We can experience greater happiness. And really think about this for yourself and want this for yourself. And give yourself the space to fulfill that potential, truly wishing yourself to be happy. And then finally begin to cultivate that love towards yourself with phrases that you speak to yourself in very gentle, kind ways, and find the words that are appropriate for you. But they might be something like, may I be happy, may I be safe, free from harm and danger. May I have all that I need to be truly happy, peaceful, satisfied. May all my thoughts and actions be positive and all my experiences good and beneficial. So again, just come up with the words that work for you. But speak to yourself in these ways, really genuinely wanting yourself to have true happiness, temporal happiness, all the way through the ultimate happiness of liberation and enlightenment. And just keep repeating these loving thoughts towards yourself. As you continue to hold these thoughts towards yourself, wanting yourself to be truly happy, imagine that the warm energy of loving kindness in your heart, whatever kind of energy is there, not being judgmental about that at all, just simply acknowledging whatever warm energy you have that's generated on the basis of these thoughts. Feel that it radiates out, gradually filling your entire body, your entire mind, and you become suffused with happiness and all the causes of happiness. That becomes your whole being. As you continue to say these words of care, of love towards yourself, may I be happy. And having done this for ourselves, again, no judgment on any success we've had with it, just whatever has happened is good enough. But we now want to extend this to others. And we're going to work with someone who's from that group of what we consider to be friends, dear ones. And here you might choose somebody who you find that your heart opens up naturally to. That could be, again, a person in your life or a pet, someone who you feel very comfortable working with and trying to extend loving kindness to them. Visualize them in the space before you, here in your presence. And remind yourself that just like you, this being wants to be happy. Wants the causes of happiness and has the potential to do that, to experience that. And begin to cultivate thoughts of loving kindness towards this being with similar words to what you use towards yourself. Thinking things like, may you be happy. May you be safe, free from any danger or harm. May you have all that you need to be truly happy, to be peaceful, to be fully satisfied. May you have only good experiences. May you be filled with bliss. May you be happy. And find the words that work for you and just cultivate that thought continually towards that being in front of you, opening your heart more and more with loving kindness. imagine once more any loving kindness that you feel in your heart. Feel it completely fill your being. And extend that out to the being in front of you, watching them filled with happiness, all the causes of happiness. See them in that state of having achieved that fully, completely. And then we're going to jump to the level of working with all sentient beings, the third part of this meditation. And we can once more recognize that in this field of beings that we're visualizing, not just our friends or difficult people, but the countless other beings that we don't know that are strangers, this vast ocean of beings going out in all directions, that there is not one of those beings who is not the same as you in that fundamental desire to be happy, to have the causes of happiness. And recalling once more that every one of those beings also has the potential to achieve unparalleled bliss and well-being. They simply have not created the causes yet. But they deserve that happiness. They are entitled to that happiness. And begin to generate thoughts of loving kindness and of seeing that all these beings are a part of supporting us in their own way. We are connected to all of these beings. Our own temporal happiness arises on the basis of our positive actions towards these beings. We are indebted to them for that. All of our temporal needs are provided by these beings. The food that we eat, the clothes we wear, the houses we live in. These beings are involved in fulfilling our temporary needs. And we are indebted to them for that. And moreover, we need every one of those beings as a support for our ultimate attainment of enlightenment. We will not be able to become a Buddha without every one of those beings as the object of our positive mind. So we need these beings, and we can feel a great indebtedness to them. And begin to open your heart with thoughts of loving kindness that are based upon all that you receive from these beings, all the amazing benefits that you accrue because of them, through them, using them as a support. And then we'll cultivate a measurable love towards them by reciting the verse one line at a time. The first one, this immeasurable aspiration, thinking of how amazing, how incredible it would be if all these beings who have been so kind to us were to have happiness and its causes. How wonderful it would be if all sentient beings had happiness and the causes of happiness. Again, feel your heart open with that thought. That aspiration. And then this stronger thought that's more of a wish or a prayer, where we imagine that we are the ruler over a domain and making that decree, saying, may this be so for these beings who have been so kind to us. May they have happiness and its causes. I really want this to come to pass. Want this for each and every one of these beings. And then seeing that we are the ones that benefit from these beings in our lives, that they have been responsible for our temporal happiness, our well-being, and it will be the basis upon which we generate our ultimate well-being and enlightenment, we take that personal responsibility, we make that deeper commitment to being the cause, the agent by which these beings will find that happiness and the causes of happiness. Let's recite that third line with as much of that sense of personal responsibility as you can bring up to accompany this thought. I myself will cause them to have happiness and its causes. And then seeing that we do need the inspiration and blessings of the holy beings, our own gurus, all those enlightened beings who are dedicated to helping us, who without a doubt have the ability to influence us in positive ways, to help us to increase our qualities, to diminish our negative tendencies. We invoke all of that in the presence of, or in the form of, forearm Chenrezig, this white, brilliant Buddha who's appearing in the space above you on a lotus and a moon seat, sitting in the Vajra posture, his first two arms at his heart holding a wish-fulfilling jewel, his second left arm holding a lotus that's fully blooming, his second right hand holding a crystal rosary. The embodiment of all these qualities in the form of a Buddha. We invoke his presence in order to receive the blessings of our gurus, the blessings of the holy beings, to be able to accomplish this. That from our side, it's important for us to extend that commitment, but we're not alone in this. We do have others who can help us. And so we recite that last line with that thought. Please, Guru Deity, grant me blessings to be able to do so. Then visualize that from the heart of Chenrezig, white light and nectar descends down, enters the crown of your own head, completely removing all the obstacles to generating perfect love for all beings, especially your own anger, aversion, any of your attachment or self-concern, all the things that get in the way of cultivating that genuine heart of love. All of them removed, and you yourself are now filled with loving kindness for all beings. And then dedicate the positive potential to having done this meditation on loving kindness so that you can actually attain that state of Buddhahood and be the cause that will help sentient beings to find true happiness and all the causes of happiness. So any questions before we go into a little more detail on some of the points that were in the meditation that I didn't have a chance to cover this morning? Yes, Linda.
I just have a quick question about last night. You mentioned mm-hmm. for each of the four stanzas, for each of the four immeasurables,
mm-hmm.
each one represents like immeasurable something,
uh-huh.
and I missed two of them. So I have for the first one immeasurable aspiration, and the last one immeasurable like request.
Right.
But I missed the middle two.
The second one is an immeasurable wish or prayer.
Okay.
So when we say, may they, da-da-da-da-da, that's like that wish or prayer that actually come to pass.
Uh-huh.
Then the third is the immeasurable extraordinary thought, or we could call it resolve.
Okay.
If you wanted to shorten it, an extraordinary resolve.
Great.
That, you know, immeasurable thought that you could be doing that for all beings, you know, so.
Thank you.
Sure. So I realize, it would have been better to maybe do the full instruction before doing the meditation, but you've got the meditation that you can take home with you and work on it on your own. But there are some points that are useful in terms of once we take this outside of just our friends, because our friends, it's kind of easy to see the ways that they've been kind because they've been quite directly and intentionally kind to us. And so what I put together for you to meditate on the kindness of beings is on pages 8 and 9 of your packet there. I put it in there as sort of an addendum. If you go to page 8, you'll see that the addendum 1 points for meditation on the kindness of all beings. You could do this as a separate meditation, but you can also simply reflect on these when you're working with a particular person from that group. As I mentioned earlier, I mean, we do want to work with individuals as much as possible, because when we just have this general thought, it works to a degree, and it's very nice to go to that and kind of go to that at the end to say, you know, may all beings have this. That's very nebulous in some ways. And when we start working with individuals, Lama Tsongkhapa even gives the advice that when we're working with any of these types of qualities, that we work with individuals as much as possible, because otherwise, if we just say, oh, may all beings, oh, but not you, you know, there'll be like, you know, we'll have an almost visceral reaction to exclude people at some level, simply because we haven't trained ourselves to use individuals. We haven't really trained ourselves in that idea that we want to work with individuals as much as possible. Now, as I said, you can't work with everybody. I mean, it's going to be impossible to have all strangers included in your meditation. But you work with enough to where you feel comfortable with that idea that when you're seeing somebody, you're out traveling, whatever, you go to the airport, there's all these people walking every way, which way. I get experience with this now that I'm out traveling to teach. You know, and you just try to look at every one of them through some lens of understanding that they're a stranger, but they're still an object for your loving kindness. They're an object for your compassion. So you want to work enough with strangers to get that feeling towards anyone that you meet that's a stranger. And of course, the most difficult people to work with are the difficult people, are the enemies, those people that are in that category, because it's going to be quite challenging for us to cultivate those thoughts. So this idea of meditating on the kindness of all beings, I introduce here with immeasurable love, because this is where we feel that kind of sense of a wish to reciprocate kindness, which usually means that we want to be equally involved in helping them, bringing them to happiness. So what I put together there is for each of these, to meditate on the kindness of those who are your friends and loved ones, for example. As I said, this is where it's quite easy, because those are beings who are directly and intentionally kind to us. So it should be easy to recognize and appreciate that, because we can think about them and go, oh, this, you know, my dear whatever, fill in the blank, my dear pet, my dear partner, my dear son, daughter, parent, whatever the case might be. You know, you will naturally have the heart open because you can see their kindness quite clearly, because they have done things that you've directly appreciated from. And you can certainly think about those who have in the past and currently do contribute to your welfare quite directly, your parents, siblings, grandparents, etc., and feel a deep appreciation for the kindness that you receive from these dear ones in your life. So once you've got that appreciation for their kindness and you feel that sense of gratitude, then it's very easy to open your heart with thoughts of loving kindness towards them. So the idea behind this is that when you get to that second step, back on the meditation on immeasurable love, that second step starts on the bottom of page 2, that when you start with friends, you would do a meditation like that, that just helps you to remind yourself of the way that those beings who you're going to work with, who are friends, have been kind in that way. And what they do say, Lama Tsongkhapa, when he gives advice on working with ideas like loving kindness, is that you do start with the person or the being that it's easiest for you to open your heart to. And then you bring in the one that's maybe like the next easiest. And then you try to get them all to the same level as the easiest, as the one that you can open your heart to quite naturally. And so then you bring in more of, you know, one by one, all these friends, till you feel quite comfortable with that whole category of friends. Then you start working with strangers, and as I said, work with enough strangers to be able to have that for all strangers, and then eventually with the difficult people. So when it gets to strangers, on the bottom of page 8, these are mostly, you know, those who are indirectly and usually unintentionally kind to us. And this is where we start enlarging what we mean by kindness. Kindness in Buddhism, when we start talking in this way, isn't defined by the intention of the person who's doing the act that we benefit from. It's defined by the fact that we benefit from that. So when we start talking about receiving kindness, it doesn't matter whether that person was wanting to be kind intentionally or directly. It really just is whether we have benefited from them. And we know that we benefit from others who are strangers in many ways. So the top of page 9, it says, this includes those, whether human beings or animals, who help us to have all the possessions we use and enjoy, such as the food that we eat, the clothes that we wear, the cars we drive, the houses we live in, and so forth. I mean, there is nothing that we have in our lives that came solely from ourselves. You know, we have benefited so much from others. And most of those we're quite blind to, because they're not the friends in the front row. They're the people in the dark of the theater that are doing all these things for us that we benefit from. And we don't have that awareness that they've done that. And we can't make that assumption about anybody. As you go about your business and, you know, in town or what have you, you can't make the assumption that any stranger on the street isn't somehow involved in your welfare. Yeah. They very much could be. They could be the person that helps your cell phone to operate and have all the, you know, programming and everything. They could be a person who, you know, is responsible for some of the food that's stocked on your shelves that you eat. You know, we don't know the role that those beings play. But because you benefited, you can see it as a kindness. It doesn't mean that they have to intend kindness. Maybe they were just doing it because they're getting paid to do it. Well, you know, that's good enough. You've benefited from what they've done. So in that way, it's a kindness. So again, we start enlarging on the definition of kindness in this meditation. We don't see kindness just as those direct acts when somebody's giving you something nice or what have you. We see it as any way that we've benefited from others. And they also, you know, they're not intentionally directing it at you. And I kind of joke sometimes that whoever was responsible for putting this shirt together that I'm wearing, it doesn't mean that they sat there and said, oh, I can't wait till Don wears that shirt, you know. We'll make Don so happy, right, you know. There's no connection between the people who sewed the shirt and myself in the sense of a personal direct line of, you know, an intentional line that made me benefit from that. But regardless, they did what they did. All the beings that were involved in this, you know, putting the buttons together and the sewing and the design and the fabric and everything else. Right? So there's many beings involved in all the things that we have. And even if the beings that you're seeing as strangers aren't involved in that capacity, they might be supporting and helping the people who do those jobs. You know, it's a vast network of interconnection. It's not like only one individual here and then stops there. You know, what was that movie, 6 Degrees of Separation? You know, you got not that many degrees of separation between ourselves and any being on the planet. You know, in terms of how they are involved in our welfare indirectly. And it says then to think about those who have in the past and currently do contribute to your welfare in this way, and once more, generate some sense of appreciation, some gratitude for that in your life. Then your heart will open up much more naturally to wanting them to be happy, because you see that they're not kind of separate and isolated from you. They are actually beings who have contributed to your welfare. Then we get to those who are difficult. This is where it becomes more challenging, but there's a logic to this too. We can see these beings as kind in their own way. As it says under point 3A there, in this category of difficult people are those who are actually what we often see as the opposite of kind. since they are directly and intentionally harmful to us or those that we care about through their behavior, their views, and so on. And yet, we can still see what appears to be unkind as a kindness, since without such challenging people in our lives, we cannot develop and strengthen our compassion, our love, and our patience. So this is the role that those beings play for us, and they don't intend to be kind at all. You know, it's the exact opposite. They're being mean and cruel and vicious, perhaps, at least being, you know, unkind in some way. But you can benefit from those beings in your life. In fact, they often speak to the fact that as you continue on the path and you create less and less karma for those people in your life, they become rarer and rarer. And every time one of those comes into your life, you should be so happy that they're in your life. This is a bit of what's going to be going on with the Monday night class on discovering Buddhism, when we talk about transforming problems and difficult situations into the path. I'll be here to do the first class of that on Monday, but this is kind of taking that whole reverse perspective, that what we see and experience as unkindness, we can view as being kindness, because we need those people in our lives. You know, there's many stories that kind of support this. There's the one story of the monk that was up meditating in the cave, and I think they attribute it to Patril Rinpoche, who came by and said, "Hey, you know, how's it going? What are you doing?" And starts talking to the monk, and the monk was on his little break from meditation. He says, "So what are you meditating on?" And the monk says, "Well, I'm meditating on patience." And he says, "Oh, patience." And so then the master goes up there and starts mucking with everything in the guy's meditation cave until he gets him totally annoyed. And then he says, "Ah, where's your patience now?" You know, if you don't have people pushing your buttons, you can sit on your cushion and meditate on patience all day, but you're not going to know what it's like to practice patience. So we need these people. You know, we can be grateful that we have people that are pushing our buttons in this world. Doesn't mean that we approve what they do. That's not what we're saying here. We're saying as long as they're doing what they're doing, let's make good use of it. Let's actually use it as a way to enhance our own qualities. There's a story of Lama Atisha, who, you know, as you know, came to Tibet about 1,000 years ago, made this incredible journey to be able to teach there. And the story goes that before he left India, he decided he would bring along this Bengali tea boy who really pushed his buttons, somebody who he found so annoying. It's hard for me to imagine Lama Atisha being annoyed at somebody, but so he brought this guy along so that he could practice patience all the way there, because he was worried when he got to Tibet there wouldn't be anybody to practice patience with. So he'd bring along his own little companion to do that. Of course, the story goes that once he got to Tibet, he realized he didn't need to do that, that the Tibetan people were quite capable of pushing his buttons too. But so, I mean, I'm not suggesting you do this, like you travel around with somebody who really annoys you, but try being with somebody who really annoys you for just a short period of time and try to practice patience. Yeah. So we can see this as a kindness. It says here again, think about those who have in the past and currently made your life or the lives of those you love difficult, and try to see how you could utilize what has happened as a way to develop your positive qualities. And try to cultivate a sense of appreciation for this form of kindness that you can experience from all these difficult people who are the perfect opportunity for deepening your qualities. So in this way, when we've looked at these three categories, and I would encourage you, as I said, to gradually work with these. You can certainly test it out and just see what it's like to pull one of the people from the enemy camp into your field of vision and work with them and try to experience some loving kindness towards them on the basis of these thoughts. But the idea is that we can see that there's nobody in those three groups that we can exclude as having been kind to us. And therefore, there's no one we can exclude about extending our loving kindness to them. So this is the kind of addendum that helps fill in the loving kindness meditation to a large degree. I think it's quite useful there. It has its uses within immeasurable compassion as well, and I'll talk about that when we get to that this afternoon. Let's see, was there something else in the meditation? Oh, yeah, when we go back to the meditation, any questions on that? Is everyone kind of seeing what we mean by kindness? I had one time I gave a teaching in Santa Fe, and there was one gentleman there who refused to see. He says, "That's not kindness at all, the person who like pushes your buttons." And I was going, I'm not saying it's kindness the way we normally think about it. It's our choice to see it as kindness because of what we can benefit from that, how we can benefit from that. But this person couldn't get it. I don't know. was probably my faulty explanation, but anyway. Anyone have any questions or comments about that? So let's go back to the meditation on immeasurable love, and then, as I mentioned, that is what supports you in the second bullet point there at the bottom of page 2, cultivating love for friends, strangers, and enemies, trying to develop an even-mindedness for all three. As it says at the top of page 3, you want to kind of think of the way that they've been kind to you, and then wishing them happiness in a similar way as when we work on ourselves. Now, again, find what wording works for you. You know, simply having that thought, may you be happy, works for some people. May you have the causes of happiness. But, you know, find the ways that you want to communicate that within your own meditation. So when we finally get to cultivating love for all beings, here's where we can also kind of extend our view of kind of their kindness in these three major ways. That when we talk about all sentient beings in a very broad way, we can say that we need those sentient beings, first of all, for our temporal happiness. As it says there under that point one, under that first arrow, wealth, favorable rebirths, and so forth, all come from the merit or good karma that we generate, which is generally done in dependence upon helping and not harming others. So we need others to practice generosity, right? You know, you can't practice generosity without someone to give to. Well, I guess you can. They say in the Kadampa, one Kadampa master said you practice generosity first by giving something from one hand to the other. You know, oh, thank you, thank you. Oh, here you go. Oh, thank you. And it's kind of silly, but we see how limited generosity is when there's not another being. You know, if I give this to Christine, then it's, you know, I'm extending, of course I don't own this, I can't really give it, but it's extending out to another person, and it's helping them, wanting to benefit them. So we need others to practice generosity. And generosity is the main karma by which you achieve having resources in your life. Being attentive to your morality and not killing others, not harming others, is how you achieve a good rebirth and making sure that you have a good health and a long life. All of the things that we create, that we experience the benefit of, are done in relation to others. We need other beings to do that. You can't do that in isolation. So, as that's the first way that these beings are kind of related to you in terms of giving you an incredible gift by just being in the world as an object of our generosity and kindness and so on. The second point is that all of our temporal needs are provided at least in part by others. This is very similar to how we meditated on strangers, but we can say that even our friends and even the difficult people might be quite involved in terms of our welfare. You know, just as we said that about strangers, we can think that about all beings. For example, our food is grown, processed, packaged, distributed, sold by others. And think about, you know, all the insects involved in our food being produced and so on, many beings. So we're not living, again, in isolation. Our temporal needs are being provided, at least in part, by the kindness of others. And then finally, the third one is what I was mentioning in the meditation, that in the end, all of our ultimate attainments are dependent upon others. When we generate the thought of bodhicitta, which again we'll talk about tomorrow afternoon, it's on the same basis that all of these thoughts are, which is all sentient beings. In fact, you cannot generate true bodhicitta if you exclude any one being from that. You need every single being. Rinpoche often talks this way, that you have to think that every being that you meet is the source of all your past, present, and future happiness. And in that way, they are the source of your ultimate happiness. You know, we need Donald Trump as a support for our bodhicitta. We need Barack Obama as a support for our bodhicitta. We need every single being in the world as a support for our bodhicitta. You cannot become enlightened without having them as a basis for that. So this is the most ultimate way that all beings are involved in our own welfare. And I'm not, again, through these meditations, we're not trying to make it all about ourselves, not coming back to that place of self-centeredness. It's so that when we feel the kindness that we receive from others and what they do for us, we have a desire to reciprocate, a desire to be involved in their happiness to that level, to that degree. So any questions on any of this about immeasurable love? I think I might be kind of done with this topic. But yes, Anna, the microphone's coming.
I believe it's His Holiness the Dalai Lama. Mm-hmm. Lama Zopa Rinpoche also, that we need to do this because There is not one sentient being who has not been our mother.
Right.
And
right.
when my mom was dying, or after she passed away, Lama Zopa Rinpoche said to me, "She's been your mother many lifetimes."
Right.
So that's interesting.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we'll talk about this a little bit tomorrow when we go through the techniques of developing bodhicitta. The one that has to do with Tonglen is the equalizing and exchanging self and others, and then the sevenfold cause and effect starts with that premise. That's the first step, is to say, all beings have been my mother. Yeah. I think it really does. I mean, you've probably heard this before. Many of these Tibetan lamas, when they came to the West and realized that relationships with mothers in the West are sometimes more complicated. I'm sure they're complicated in the East, too. But nonetheless, you know, they can be a bit complicated. So when people were being told, see all beings as having been your mother, it was like, really? You know? I had the good fortune of having a very kind mother in my life. She's still in my life. So, I mean, I feel really privileged in that way. But, you know, not everybody has that experience. So, again, it doesn't matter. The mother is used as an image because it's a very powerful archetype in our culture, regardless of what an individual person has done as our mother. We know that it's a very powerful way that someone can be quite closely involved in our welfare when we're at a particularly vulnerable age, when we're really quite young and do require someone to support us. And mothers are generally the person playing that role, but not always. You know, sometimes it's grandmothers, and sometimes it's sisters and brothers and fathers and everyone else. So, you know, we'll talk about this a bit tomorrow, but use whatever works for you. But this is a very powerful way to think of others as being our mothers. We even use that phrase, mother sentient beings. Again, if it works for you, it's great, but not all of us will have the ability to use that as the way that we will see others. But thanks for bringing that up. So we see that this idea of kindness, I introduced it here because kindness is one of those ways we open our hearts when we have recognized the kindness we've experienced from others. And every one of us knows this from our own lives, right? How good it has felt to be the object of someone else's kindness, particularly those people that are in our front row that are quite directly and intentionally kind to us. But we have to once more enlarge our view of kindness, because otherwise we're going to only be defining it on the basis of that. Only those people who've done something quite directly and intentionally kind to us will we consider them to be kind. And that's because when we get into compassion, we see that we need to feel a sense of closeness to others, especially for compassion, especially for it to work. So, yeah, Andre.
I'm probably being really picky again, so I apologize.
But okay.
When it's kind of hard to really see. I get it, and I try to practice it, and I try to see it that way. But it's kind of difficult to really see that all acts as kindness. You know, even if we benefit from them.
Right.
Because maybe someone will begrudgingly do something for us.
Mm-hmm.
From his side, that really wasn't kindness. And so therefore, I don't know exactly how, just because I benefited from, I can say, well, that was being kind, because he really wasn't being kind. He felt, right. I have no other choice but to, or him.
Right.
There you go. You know,
right.
It's like, you know, it's so, I hate to be picky, but I'm just like.
So the question would be, what's the difference between that person who's doing something begrudgingly and the enemy who's harming you?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you have an opportunity with both of those cases to actually generate deeper qualities towards those beings, because you see how the person who's doing it begrudgingly or the person who's even doing something harmful are under the control of their own delusions and doing things out of that negative state of mind, and are an object only of your love and compassion, mm-hmm. as opposed to an object of your hatred or disdain. And you also can practice patience in the face of others being like that, rather than retaliating.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I mean? I don't think there's a huge difference between those people who are doing something begrudging, because we're never talking about the measure of the kindness we receive being based on the kindness that person is intending.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So even the person who is like your arch nemesis, you know, your the Riddler to your Batman or whatever.
Yeah, right.
You
yeah.
know, whatever, you know, superhero you use and their arch enemy, you know, even that person, we're not they have the nothing but bad intention towards us. They have nothing but ill will towards us. But we're going to choose to see it as kindness because we can generate deeper qualities on the basis of what we're experiencing.
Well, riddle me this.
Very good.
Is it possible to develop these good qualities of compassion and stuff and still recognize this person really wasn't being kind?
Sure.
So recognize, seeing what we see, because the whole idea is to actually see things as they really are, not as we...
Well, exactly.
Yeah.
And that's where we're not talking about creating a fiction here in terms of, oh, that person is really just fine. They're actually being really kind. You know, they're a Buddha in disguise that's doing all these wonderful things for me. Well, I mean, you could hold that view. Maybe that might be going too far, but... We don't ever deny the reality of what's going on. There are beings who are under the control of their crazy delusions that are harming others and that are harming us. And that is something we totally oppose. But we recognize that while we are on the receiving end of that, it's an amazing opportunity to actually practice patience and kindness. It also doesn't mean that that's all that we do, is practice patience and kindness while the person continues to do what they're doing. We do what we can to address it, but you're never going to address it effectively with a mind of hatred and anger. You're only going to address it effectively with a mind of compassion and kindness and love and concern, because then you see what's going on more clearly. As you're saying, it is in line with the truth. The truth is, this is a being under the control of their karma and delusions and doing all these crazy things that are going to cause them harm as well as harm others. And myself. So I want them to stop. But while I'm on the receiving end of it, I also see that I have to get rid of my anger. I have to not follow those habitual patterns and instead be patient and kind and tolerant in that way, and then also do the work to help them. And sometimes we can't do that work. Like I said, I can't fly over to Syria and Iraq and try to find the members of ISIS and, you know, say, I'd like to convince you to be a kinder person, you know, because I really care about you. And you're creating a lot of negative karma by all the things that you're doing. I mean, my head would be gone in like 5 seconds, you know. So in the meantime, I can sit on my cushion and think about the members of ISIS and be really challenged and like, how can I generate a mind that sees what they're doing as some measure of kindness for myself, not kindness in terms of the beings that they're harming, but kindness for myself because it helps me to extend my compassion even to people doing those atrocities. You see what I mean? You know, it's hard. I'm not saying this is an easy thing, but yeah, Aaron.
It sounds like you're saying there's a difference between someone intentionally performing an act of kindness mm-hmm. and us just receiving something as a kindness. And maybe there's other words, like if I was meditating and I would think, is it a lesson? Is it a kindness? Is it a benefit? Is it, you know, this thing that I received?
Sure. I think benefit is a good word to think of because, again, benefit is always determined by the person who is receiving it. It's not, you know, determined by the person who's doing it. Because even if you have somebody who's being intentionally kind to you, but what they give you, you don't benefit from, well, you know, I don't know. Maybe that is a better word to look at. You still can benefit from those beings in your life rather than putting this label of kindness. I don't know, all the great teachers that I've had, you know, always use this word of kindness to refer to these individuals. Lama Zopa in particular talks about the kindness of the enemy. It's one of his...
Yeah, I think it's just in our language and our culture, we think of kindness as coming from the other person.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've had a lot of words in Buddhism that the first time I heard, I couldn't use that word that all the great teachers used. It didn't make sense to me to say kindness until later down the road or whatever.
Right.
So...
No, and I think what you're saying, Aaron, goes for everybody in the room, that find the language that works for you, but I present it in the way that I've been taught it because that's the language that, you know, I think is kind of the way that I need to transmit it. But understand these concepts in your own language and in what works for you, how you can see it, so that you can then reframe it. I use this word reframe to refer to what almost all of Buddhism is about. It's about reframing our situation. But not reframing it with just like a wild imagination, reframing it in terms of trying to come closer to truth. Yeah. Because if we do really understand what's operative, and we haven't quite touched on that with the compassion teachings, we'll get into that in terms of the situation that we are in, why we're in that situation, how we would effectively change it, you know, all of those things that are taught as the Four Noble Truths, the very basis of all the Buddhist teaching. If we don't have that kind of understanding, then we can't have a basis or a platform from which to reframe and, you know, view everything in a much different light. Because if you're only going to follow worldly ways, well then, yeah, absolutely, the person who's there, who's harming you, is an absolute idiot, and we need to do everything we can to just get them out of our lives. And, you know, if we have to kill them, whatever, you know. That's what kind of makes sense at the world at large, not that we're all killing each other, not yet. Let's hope that never happens. But that's the mentality, you know. That's what we've all kind of bought into in terms of reality. But when you understand what's going on in terms of the Four Noble Truths, then there's no way that you would see that person who's harming you through that lens of wanting to harm them back. It doesn't make sense for yourself or for them.
I'd like to say something. On the other side of the story is, and I think that's even more important than being concentrating on others hurting us, is mm-hmm. how many people have we hurt,
right.
and to make amends. I find as I'm getting older, if I hurt someone, it torments me. I'm ready to just commit suicide. And I it's like, what did I do? I mean, I've written letters to people, my sisters and all. If I've ever hurt you, please forgive me and all. And I have peace in my heart. Otherwise, I can't live with myself. It's really, I'm ready to get, you know, Prozac or something.
I feel that,
you know. So to me, that's even more important than someone hurting me.
Right.
Mine not hurting someone else.
Right.
I mean, really.
Yeah. And what you're saying, Anna, this is going to come into play with the measurable compassion. I mean, because the measurable compassion is where we look at kind of how those thoughts inform our refraining from causing suffering for others, because we don't want them to suffer in the least. And it also reframes... Exactly. And it allows us to seek forgiveness of ourselves, to be able to apologize, to be able to live in harmony with others, all these things, once we start to really understand that. No, I agree. This is definitely a key part of it. I mean, each of us is going to have our own thing that we need to work on. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I agree. So were there any other questions on immeasurable love? Yes. And is it Lori? Yeah.
I have been trying to put this into words and thinking about people that you're very close to, that you end up, they hurt you or you hurt them, and that creates a gap. But how do you see past that in those situations where you have space maybe to...
Mm-hmm.
get the patience and have the loving kindness.
So could you give are you comfortable giving an example? I don't want to put
you
on the spot.
So we recently, my family was on a trip and we went to a special place and it required an early morning get up to go because we were seeing the sunrise on a volcano. And during that time, I have a son who was like, when can we leave now? When can we leave? And so I was feeling like, here we are supposed to enjoy this great experience. And he's, can we leave? And my husband was just doing it because I wanted to. I felt like he was doing it because I wanted to. But I was hurt by that, but also feeling like maybe I wasn't seeing things from their side.
Right, right.
I just don't know how to...
Yeah, yeah. And thanks for sharing that. I can tell it was a difficult situation for you. So, but I think there is a side of it where we do, and this is what we're going to talk a bit about in immeasurable compassion, is this idea of empathy. Empathy is where we are able to see things from the point of view of another person, to kind of put ourselves in their shoes and really feel what's going on for them. And I think that is a key part of how we kind of work with others in life, those people in particular that are in our front row, that we have to be attentive to their needs. And sometimes it does require us to put our own needs aside, because we see that if we are genuinely concerned about them, then we need to attend to what they do. Now, nonetheless, it doesn't mean that we become, again, like a doormat and nothing, we never have any ability to do anything we want, because that's not usually helpful for the other people either. I mean, if you have somebody who you simply keep buying into. This is what we mean by codependency, right? Where you have, even to that degree, where you have people who have addictions and you just keep buying into what they say they need, and you never do anything to address them taking responsibility for their lives in different ways. You could imagine having a child and you just continue to tie their shoes until they're like 40. You know, well, you know, that may, they may like having their shoes tied for them, but it doesn't teach them any responsibility of how to be in the world,
right.
You know. So that's not a kindness any longer. That's not kind of any sort of empathy. It's become an abuse of that. So once more, we talk about these two wings, and these are important to have, the sort of soft-hearted compassion and love and care and concern, but the wisdom to know what needs to be done at any particular time. So, I mean, I can't speak to all the dimensions of your particular situation, but I would say there needs to be maybe, again, a balance of those two. Some understanding that, you know, maybe it required before everyone's, you know, and yes, there's the rush to get up to the mountain or the volcano to see the sunrise and da-da-da-da, all of the things that are entailed in that. But maybe it required, you know, just a moment to say, you know, check in with everybody and see, you know, if in the end nobody else wants to go, well, then maybe it's not so important that you go. And then rather than it becoming a difficult experience of being up there and feeling like nobody else wants to be there or whatever. And you know what I'm saying? It's like I think that there, we have an opportunity at any time to sort of check in and try to develop more wisdom so that then we're not solely working with this other side of it. We also can balance it with what needs to be done.
Yeah, that's the part. I was trying to see it from their side, and, but we're there in the moment, and not
yeah.
something I could change at that point. So,
right.
And I was trying not to get upset myself
sure.
because
sure.
I wanted to enjoy it as much as possible, but
right.
I was aware of that, and
yeah.
I've run into those kinds of situations, and they're.
Right.
Difficult for me.
And if you've all agreed as a group that this is what you're going to do, and that was your thing that was on your list that you wanted to go there and make sure you enjoy it, then at some level you don't need to attend to the feelings of those others because you can be in the moment and try to enjoy it as best as you can, regardless of whether they're enjoying it. That's their choice to not enjoy it or to feel like they need to go down rather than, you know, continue to stay up there. I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, this is where we can't be like this hypersensitive to the needs of others to the degree where it just becomes kind of ridiculous. Because once more, there's not a lot of benefit to them either if we're doing that. Yeah. This is like, yeah, keep buying into other people's just kind of self-centeredness. I'm not sure that that's what, you know, is really helpful either at that point.
Well, and I was wondering if I was having self-grasping or ego-grasping in that moment.
Well, we all are, I think. You know, I think we have to be kind to ourselves, Lori, in that regard and see that we're going to have some of that operative to some degree. You know, and even if you could sit there and as you're enjoying it, say, oh, may my son enjoy this as much as I do, you know, whatever, generate those sorts of thoughts, then you're kind of like sharing it in the moment and not letting it become something that makes your mind tighter and have more, you know, bad feeling about the way that he's reacted or whatever. I think that there's ways to work with it. We just tend to get really tight in our own minds and think that we push through based on our own habitual patterns, and we have to challenge some of those and see whether they're really helpful or not. Do they really give us more spaciousness in the moment, give us more ability to react or I guess a better word is respond more creatively to what's going on rather than reacting more habitually. So again, I hope that gives you a few things to kind of work with there. But and this is the reality, you know, of our lives, is that we are going to be disappointed. As I mentioned, those people in the front row are sometimes our worst enemies because they know how to get to us worse than a lot of the other people that are just bursting into the theater, you know, and trying to upset our show. They know us quite intimately. And this is very true, right? A lot of nodding heads, I think, you know, that yes, we know that they're the people who we sometimes are harmed by the greatest because of that proximity. And we have to be willing to sort of examine that and not, you know, feel too bent out of shape and too sensitive from our own side to that and recognize that those people in the front row are not perfect. Our view of them through the lens of attachment is that they're all wonderful and delightful and delicious, and we want them to stay that way. But they also have their own foibles, their own faults. We have to be willing to accept them as who they are and not expect that everything's going to be perfect. It's just part of the nature of the beast, I think. But how wonderful that you got to go up there and see the sunrise. You know, we can rejoice in that. So these are tough things to work with sometimes. Yes. What's your name?
Laura.
Hi, Laura.
Hi. I don't know if I'm going to be able to ask this correctly either. It's kind of a little twist from feeling disappointment from loved ones or strangers, the equanimity, but more of the compassion.
Mm-hmm.
The compassion and equanimity, I understand. It's a matter of, for the people in your audience who are very close,
right.
Is there such a thing as too much compassion,
mm.
as to where you feel the suffering a little too much?
Right, right.
And so the question becomes,
mm-hmm.
you want to be compassionate, and there isn't a separateness, but yet, mm. where's that healthy, you know, way to deal with the compassion for right. someone else's suffering versus, you know, wanting to fix it, wanting to help
mm-hmm.
versus just being there with kindness.
Right. That's like the perfect segue into compassion, because we're going to talk about empathy
okay.
and this idea of a balanced empathy that is the place where we want to come from in terms of how we enact that compassion with others in particular. So if you can hold on for
yes.
just a minute, and we'll
yes.
get to that, Laura. Thank
okay.
you for bringing that up. Yeah. So shall we move into compassion? If anyone needs to stand up and stretch, let's just do that. Because, again, I feel like after people have been sitting for about an hour, things start falling asleep, and it's nice to just get up and do a little stretching or something, and then we can continue. Okay, everyone stretched? You don't have to run a mile after this or anything. You know, this is just to be able to sit for a little bit longer. So on Laura's topic, let's go ahead and move into compassion. And maybe I won't talk about empathy right away, but know that this is really a key part, particularly when we talk about compassion. We can say that empathy is involved in all of these, you know, some willingness to be able to kind of cognize what other people are going through, put ourselves in their shoes, have that kind of genuine heart connection with others that empathy is the starting point for. But let's go to the sheet on compassion. Again, this is on page 3 of your packet there. Compassion, I'll just read what Kathleen McDonald says. She says, compassion arises out of our own experience of suffering. We all know what it's like to be sick or in pain, to be lonely or have our feelings hurt by an unkind remark, to fear the unknown or grieve the death of a loved one. When we then see or hear of others going through similar experiences, our heart opens with a feeling of empathy and the wish to help. This is kind of what distinguishes these two. And we're going to talk about empathy, because empathy is that initial kind of willingness to extend out and identify what's going on. Compassion is the desire to have that relieved. His Holiness uses the example in the Book of Joy that if you saw somebody who was under a rock, you know, your goal wouldn't be just to know what it's like to be under a rock. You know, it would be to actually remove the rock, right, so that they don't have to continue to be crushed by it. So we see that there's empathy is a way to get to compassion, but it's not the full picture. You know, empathy alone is not enough. So that's why she says empathy, feeling of empathy and the wish to help. This is compassion, the wish for oneself and others to be free of suffering, free from all painful, unwanted, unsatisfactory experiences. It acknowledges that everyone wants to be free of suffering, deserves to be free, and has the capacity to be free. So it's based on a lot of the same thoughts that we saw earlier, the sameness of others, that we're all the same in our fundamental situation. So let's talk a little bit about empathy, because I think it does touch on this idea that Laura brought up too, that one of the, maybe I'll introduce these and then we'll go into empathy. When we talk about compassion, this desire to have the suffering of others or oneself alleviated, to have it relieved, there's a far enemy of this, and then there are two near enemies of this. Now, Thupten Jinpa in his book only points out one near enemy, but the second one is something that will lead me into this discussion about our empathy and making sure that it's more balanced. The first thing that was mentioned was the far enemy of compassion. The far enemy of compassion, anyone know what this is? What is your thought of somebody who is totally uncompassionate in the moment? What are they doing? They're being what?
Self-centered
to some degree, but how is that manifesting in terms of
insincere?
Empathetic? I'm not hearing the word yet. Sorry. I'll just give you the word. Cruelty. So, I mean, if you've ever seen, Chogyam Trungpa actually uses this as an example of how he was able to stir up compassion in his heart, was that he would think about the cruelty that young boys were showing, to a puppy that they were stoning. And that like kind of brings up this well of compassion because he sees and this is what's interesting, is we often have the most compassionate responses in the face of the worst cruelty that we see. But cruelty is the exact opposite of compassion. It is where, going back to that idea of the soft spot, where somebody has completely armored that soft spot, maybe there's still a crack in there, a place where you can maybe open it up and get in there. But there's this armoring over the soft spot that keeps one out of touch with one's heart. And one is capable of being cruel. I mean, I fortunately have never had that where I've been like quite intentionally cruel to animals or what have you. There's a woman who came to the center for a while who talked about how her brothers were that way. They would like to harm and, torture animals and things, and how this really broke her heart from a very young age. She just couldn't tolerate, harm to animals, and has become kind of, that's one of the main things that she's quite active around is, trying to stop harm to animals. But we do know that this exists, that people have gotten to that level of armoring that soft spot to that degree. That's the far enemy of compassion, because it's showing when compassion is more or less lacking. Now, does that mean that that person who's cruel in the moment, who's torturing a person or an animal or whatever the case might be, that they have no compassion? Again, it doesn't mean that it's completely blocked out, but it is in the space of that mind that compassion can't be seen. There's a wonderful story that I like to share. I don't think I shared this the last time I was here. There's a teacher in the Against the Stream organization. Some of you have heard of this. That God, what is his name? I'm having difficulty with names today. The son of Noah Levine, son of Stephen and Andrea Levine. I don't know if you've heard of him. Noah Levine spent some time in prison. He was raised by two incredible spiritual teachers, and he went the exact opposite direction. He needed to just kind of rebel against a lot of that. And he spent some time in prison, and it was then that he actually came to rely upon the teachings of the Buddha and meditation and so on to get him through his time in prison. And when he came out, he started this organization. And one of the people who teaches for him is this guy named Vinny Ferraro. And Vinny grew up in Connecticut, and I was surprised to hear in his story that there are gangs in Connecticut. I mean, you wouldn't think, I don't know. I've never been to Connecticut, so I just have this impression of it being like kind of a Spartan sort of wonderful place where, everybody's kind and very, white fence posts and, there are gangs there. And I think I can't remember the city that he was a gang in, but he was a part of a gang in, but they would go out with baseball bats at night to beat up homeless people. And the story goes that he was, in this one particular evening, came across this homeless man, and they were all sort of around him, and Vinny had his bat held high like he was going to beat this guy, and the guy connected eyes with him and said, please don't do this to me. And Vinny looked at him and said, what makes you think I'm not going to do this to you? And the man said back to him, because you have the most compassionate eyes I've ever seen. And Vinny like dropped the bat. He couldn't do it, and he could never do it again, because that armored heart was broken open. I mean, something happened by this connection. I mean, who knows? This might have been a Buddha appearing, you know, before Vinny to kind of help him on his path. But from there, he like turned the corner completely. He went into a spiritual path. He's now a teacher for their tradition. And it's quite amazing when you hear those stories. And I mean, I have no reason to suspect this story. Don't, you know, I can't vouch for its validity. I wasn't there with Vinny, you know, holding a baseball bat too. You know, but I can certainly, you know, understand that this is possible. And it means that, again, even those people who've gone to that extreme of cruelty have the potential to be compassionate. And they might not, you know, they might need something like that that's a huge catalyst for them to move in another direction. Or they might over time just be exposed to things that help them to think more compassionately. There's many stories out there. I was reading one in Lion's Roar magazine about a man who was involved with white supremacists for a number of years and doing a lot of pretty horrible things. And his path of opening started with a young woman at a cash register who's, he was being really rude and stuff, and she said to him, you know, I think you're more than what you are showing yourself to be. And that was kind of the beginning of the doorway, and it opened over time. It wasn't this huge, like, St. Paul kind of moment or something. It was rather a gradual opening. But I'm just pointing that out because even when we see, this is a helpful way to even look at people once more that we're trying to generate compassion for, that if we see them embodying this complete opposite, this far enemy of compassion, we see them being incredibly cruel, know that they still have that potential. They have the ability to waken completely to through compassion and loving kindness and become a Buddha. It's not that there's something permanent about that armoring around their heart. So that's the far enemy. The near enemies of compassion are twofold. And again, Thupten Jinpa just points out the one, which is pity. Pity kind of feels like compassion, but when, you know, sometimes we even use this word in some of our prayers, it says pitiful sentient beings. Don't think that that means that we should be generating pity for them, because pity is actually a feeling of superiority. It's a bit of like, I'm up here not suffering, you're down there suffering, oh, poor you. You know, let me do what I can to throw something at you to relieve your suffering. You know, there's that flavor to it. Not always. I mean, just in general, this is the nature of pity. So don't think that what we're aiming for is that feeling of kind of superiority and that everyone else, poor them, they're all suffering, and we can somehow benefit from that vantage point of being transcending that or something. Rather, we want to be identifying with their suffering. We want to be able to be there at the same level, understanding the sameness of the suffering that others are experiencing. But the other near enemy is really quite interesting. In the translation that is sometimes given, it's called overwhelm. And this is a bit of what Laura was talking about, I think. I might be putting words in your mouth. When we kind of feel like we've gone too far emotionally and we are almost feeling what the other person is going through to too much of a degree, to where it starts to have an effect upon us as if it's our pain. Empathy is an important kind of dimension that we have to be able to feel the pain of others. We have to be able to recognize what they're going through. But there's still the other side of empathy, which is that is still their individual experience. And if we want to be genuinely helpful at the time, we can't fall into this kind of despair or overwhelm. I think the literal translation for the term, this is according to Pema Chodron, is horrified anxiety. Horrified anxiety. I mean, that's what overwhelm feels like, right? It's an anxiety at seeing the suffering that's going on, and it's horrified, but it's paralyzed. There's not an ability to act from that place because our emotions have gotten totally caught up in it. They're totally absorbed in what's going on, and we don't have the vantage point of the other side of empathy, which is not just this, what they call affective empathy. It's spelled A-F-F-E-C-T-I-V-E, affective empathy, but rather we have to have cognitive empathy. We have to have an ability to understand that what the person is going through is still their own situation and requires us to be able to be attentive to what needs to happen to alleviate their suffering, to actually respond to it creatively. Otherwise, we just fall into the affective empathy and we just drown in it. You know, our emotions are totally with the other person. It's as if we're going through it. Well, you aren't going through it. You're trying to identify what the person's going through and be with them in their suffering. But you have to have that more kind of, again, these are a bit of like the heart and the head again. Our heart needs to be invested, but our head needs to be in control in terms of knowing how to respond effectively to what's going on. And this is where burnout comes from, what Anna's saying. I mean, burnout comes from people being too much on the affective side, where you get totally absorbed into it and you don't have the delineation any longer of yourself and the other person. And in that way, you can't, as an outside agent, help them in more constructive ways. Yeah, Renee, the microphone for Renee.
So from the Buddhist perspective, is there a technique to deal with that type of overwhelm?
Well, I would say that part of what we have to do is to, you know, again, recognize that there still is an individual experience of suffering that's going on in front of us, that we are different from that. We don't want to make ourselves totally different from that to where we no longer have the affective part of it and are only trying to cognitively solve the problem. But rather, we have to have a more balanced approach. This is why, again, this is called the balanced empathy, that we can hold both views at the same time. I would say that, again, most of it requires us to simply, you know, try to correct it as much as possible by moving in the other direction, moving in the direction of saying, and what can I do about this? It doesn't have to be this way for this person. They don't have to be suffering. Now, again, some suffering we have to accept is going on in the world, and we can't do much in the moment to alleviate it. But we can do something from our own side to work on our own qualities, rather than sitting there at our, you know, crying all day because we're just overwhelmed at all the suffering there is in the world. So regardless of what the situation is, if we go totally to the emotional side of it, it's not going to be useful. We have to be able to withdraw from that and say, this still is something that is objectively happening out there. I need to work on myself to become better qualified to address the suffering of the world, which of course the Buddhist path is entirely about. You know, how do we actually help others in that state of suffering? So there are some thoughts that can be useful, you know, to certainly practice some level of equanimity, I think, you know, to make sure that we do understand that, you know, there's an ability to kind of identify with what's going on and to see others in their situation and to want them to be free from all of that. But we still have to pull ourselves away from that to some degree. I mean, I think that each of us will have to find our own path to some degree in navigating these two, because the affective part, some of us are stronger on that side already. You know, our hearts are kind of a bit raw and open, and we naturally gravitate towards that, and we want to be with others in the space of their suffering. But then when it comes to, well, what needs to actually be done to address it, we might be weaker on that side, and we don't have quite that cognitive component. So if we recognize that we can make ourselves more qualified to deal with others' pain and suffering, then we try to correct it by moving in that direction, trying to reassert, yes, and I need to be better capable to handle the suffering of others and to address it. As I said, we can't address it in the moment, perhaps. You know, if I see people who are suffering in some part of the world, it doesn't mean that I can necessarily get on a plane, go there, and be of some use and benefit when I don't even know the skills and abilities that might be needed there. But I can respond to that suffering in more creative ways by working on myself, so I can become more capable in the state of enlightenment to relieve the suffering of all beings. You see what I mean? Other people will be much more inclined cognitively because they've got a bit more armoring around the soft spot perhaps, and they're only going to think about solving the problem and getting kind of things taken care of, but their heart's not going to be in it. You know, they're not going to be that real affectionate. It's kind of like people who have, doctors who have bad bedside manner, right? You know, they're really about fixing everything and kind of treating you as the patient that has something going wrong and they're going to take care of it. But their heart's not there with you saying, oh, I'm so sorry that you're going through this. And, you know, they're not identifying at that level. Well, then we have to correct the other way and put in more of the affective component, really kind of put ourselves in their shoes. That's what that whole affective side is all about, kind of identifying the suffering of another as if it were your own, but then recognizing that it is not your own and you have to do something as an agent to help alleviate as best as you can. Would that help a little bit? I don't know.
For everything in it.
Really? Maybe you should read it. It might be better than what I just said. What is the article, Kristen?
Oh, actually, it's from Samaritan Needs and Buddhist Ethics of Care.
From this article that I was looking at last night and wondering about, you paraphrase so much, like this fellow that wrote the book Against Empathy mentions that meditation is an important tool that diminishes empathy so one can be compassionate without suffering themselves, which you just went through. And also it says that where the Dalai Lama makes the distinction between empathy and compassion, just like Catherine MacDonald quote you read. He says, compassion in contrast is not just sharing experience with others, but wishing to see them relieved of their suffering. One can feel empathy for a neighbor whose house burned down in a fire without doing anything to help. Compassion requires taking the next step and offering them shelter. So.
Very good.
Everything that was kind of confusing me from that about this yesterday, you covered. Thank you.
Thanks for sharing that.
I think you worded it better, too.
You're too kind. So going back to this idea of this balanced empathy, when we have a balanced empathy, then our compassion is going to be very effective because we're going to be able to respond not just from the place of being with somebody in their suffering and feeling what they're feeling and kind of being able to identify at that level, but from the vantage point that we are in a position to help them in their suffering. We're in a position to help alleviate their suffering. As I said, it doesn't mean that in every situation you have the exact skills and ability to do that, because we know we don't. You know? It'd be ridiculous, again, for me to, if there's, you know, a huge medical crisis somewhere in Africa, for me to get on a plane and go there when I know nothing about medicine. You know, what am I going to do? You know? But if I can, you know, get out my checkbook or my credit card and go online and give money to Doctors Without Borders and know that they're going to go over there and do the work for me, then that's a compassionate response to that. It's not just me going, oh, those poor people, they're all suffering and I feel so bad about them, and they just start, you know, sitting in your tears. One friend of mine who's Buddhist, she knew somebody who actually went to the Dalai Lama frequently for advice on her own personal practice. And she asked the Dalai Lama once, she said, you know, I've been doing these meditations on compassion, and I find that when I start getting into that place of compassion, I just start crying, you know, just some tears. Is this a good sign? And His Holiness said, well, it's a good sign, but it doesn't mean you're there yet. Now, I don't know, I'm relating that story. This was advice given to an individual. I have no idea her whole background and her spiritual practice, but how I took it when I heard that was that just having that emotive component, that affective empathy, isn't enough. You know, if we're just kind of sitting there and just bawling our eyes out because of the suffering of the world, does that do any good in the end? I mean, it helps us to identify with suffering initially, but it's only a stepping stone to get you into that more cognitive side of it where you say, and how do I relieve the suffering of others? And that's a bit of what we're talking about with the measurable compassion in the Mahayana context. Is that we do need that component of identifying with the suffering of others. Even though it is their suffering, we need to have that willingness to feel that, to open our hearts to that. And we need to also be able to pull back and say, and I'm in a position that is different than that, and therefore I can do what I can to help alleviate that suffering. Even if it means just writing the check or sitting on your cushion and really strengthening your own bodhicitta, whatever it looks like, that is your cognitive response to the suffering of the world. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yes. Yeah, Susan.
Yeah. I used to...
Is that on?
There we go. So I used to be a therapist, and I got compassion overload. And I continue to work as a lay person with addiction. And what you had said earlier, I had stepped out about, you know, I can't tie somebody's shoes for the next 40 years.
Right.
And recognizing that, you know, part of my practice is coming to realize that I'm limited in what I can, I mean, we're talking about infinite,
right.
But in what I can actually, how I can actually assist another person
right.
is limited.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can share my experience, strength, and hope with what I've learned through the practice of Buddhism, what I've learned through the practice of a 12-step program, but in the end, the work that needs to be done is the other person's. It's not mine.
Right.
And I'm smack dab in the middle of this right now, and it is just, you know, up in my face, and I have infinite compassion for this person, and mm-hmm. I also recognize there's nothing I can do against mm-hmm. a closed mind.
Right. Right.
Except to continue to plant little seeds and let that person know that
uh-huh.
I'm not judging them as less than. I really have a deep desire for them to recover, but they have to do the work.
Right. Right. Yeah, and I appreciate that perspective, because I think that is really an important thing to acknowledge, is that when it comes to the temporal situations, frequently there is nothing more that we can do. Nonetheless, within a Buddhist perspective and the Mahayana perspective, that's further impetus for us to do the deeper work on ourselves, because we see that we can then be better qualified to help others in other ways that we can't currently do. Like if you were a Buddha, fully enlightened, maybe you are a Buddha, I don't know, but if you were fully enlightened, then you could be of so much more benefit to that person, because you would know their whole karma and everything that led them to that moment of having the addiction that they have and everything, and you could say to them things that might snap them out of it, whereas in our limited, you know, perspective, how can we possibly address it at that level? There's a wonderful quote that I wanted to share from Lama Yeshe that kind of talks about this and how bodhicitta is the answer to this. He says, if you take a proper look deep into your heart, you will see that one of the main causes of your dissatisfaction is the fact that you are not helping others as best you can. When you realize this, you'll be able to say to yourself, I must develop myself so that I can help others satisfactorily. By improving myself, I can definitely help. Thus, you have more strength and energy to meditate, to keep pure morality, and do other good things. You have energy because I want to help others. So this is where we can take the frustration we feel at a situation like that where we can't help others. We aren't able to. We're simply incapable of in our current situation, and say, I want to help them. Therefore, I need to work on myself. Yes, Diane.
And
thanks for sharing that.
That kind of leads me to a question that I had before we even gathered this session.
Mm-hmm.
I find myself in situations where there's been a wreck on the other lane in the road, or I hear about a family that got burned out of their home, or, you know, the horrors that we deal with that. And then sometimes they're even personal, but we know we're limited.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a prayer that addresses, and it may be a loving kindness prayer that we make up at the time based on what we are aware of, or is there a kind of generalist prayer? Because I feel like praying for that person or that situation sends love out there in its small way and
in a big way.
Helps me feel like I have some kind of power.
Sure. Thank you for that, Diane. No, I'd say absolutely that these sorts of prayers that we're doing, if at the moment when you see a wreck or there's something on the news about people in a horrible situation, and if at that moment we generate thoughts of loving kindness and compassion, sincerely wanting them to be free from suffering, wanting them to have happiness, I think that's very powerful. Of course, the one practice that's emphasized in this tradition, we'll talk a little bit again tomorrow afternoon, is Tonglen, is this idea that we can actually do a very visceral meditation on removing the suffering of others and giving them happiness. We'll talk about that a little bit. I think most of you in the room have some exposure to Tonglen, but I'll talk about it as part of tomorrow afternoon. I keep saying tomorrow and tomorrow, and we'll get to all these things. We'll be here till maybe 6 or 7 tomorrow night. No, just kidding. But so I don't know, I think I'll check back with Laura. Did that kind of address a bit of what your question was in terms of distortion? Yeah, okay. Because, yeah, I mean, we can get to a place where we feel a bit of that overwhelm and that kind of... Did you want to say a little bit more from your...
Well, of course, I think it's more of a challenge just as well as it's easier to have compassion for those closer to you.
Uh-huh.
It's also easier to feel, you know, the pain and suffering of those close to you.
Absolutely.
And so it's just a matter of, yes, you know, mm-hmm. that wisdom.
Right.
Of trying not to have an overwhelm.
Right.
And, yeah, even in when you're in healthcare, you know, it's kind of the same thing. It's that overwhelm. Right. It's that burnout.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it does.
Good. Okay. So, again, the whole premise for having empathy is the fact that we're not alone in our vulnerability. We all know our own vulnerability, that we are subject to suffering, that we are subject to things not going the way we want, to having to be separated from the things we love, all of this. This is part of existence, is this continual state of vulnerability or uncertainty that we have. But it's shared. Every single being is working from that same place. And so we begin to identify the common vulnerability, that common experience that we have with others. And again, be able to pull back and say, yes, but that still is their unique experience. And if I'm going to be of any use and benefit in this situation, I need to not identify with it completely at that level. I need to be able to pull back and do what needs to be done or can be done, or at least work on improving myself so I will be more capable in the future. Yeah. Okay, thanks. Yes, Andre.
I'm sort of chomping at the bit here. I'm sorry. because I think there's a misunderstanding. I've been racking my brain trying to figure. It's this textbook or this book that I use as a textbook for the guys in prison. And I can't think of the author's name, and I can't think of the book itself. It'll come to me at some point. But one of the things we tend to forget or we aren't aware of when it comes to compassion, there is a no side to compassion. You know, compassion isn't always yes, yes, yes.
Right, right.
Sometimes the most compassionate thing we can do is say no. I can't do that for you. Especially if we know that what this person is asking for or requiring will be harmful. When our children are trying to do things that we know aren't good for them, the most compassionate thing to do is to say, no, don't do that. And so we have, so when you deal with people and you're trying to teach compassion and stuff, especially in the prisons, and I don't think it's just prisons, but oftentimes they say, well, I can't do that because now I'm going to be considered a doormat and people are going to walk all over me and so forth. And that's not necessarily the case.
Right.
I tell them, you know, when I didn't live a compassionate life, when this wasn't my practice, and I lived a very self-centered life, I had people always coming over to take advantage of me all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But I've never, it could happen, but not once since I've been living, trying to practice compassion, I've had anyone try to take advantage of me. Mm-hmm. In fact, I find people who want to help me, who want to understand, well, how do you do that, you know, and so forth. You know, so it's like, and so I think we have this misunderstanding about compassion. We think it's all soft and all, and this is why we get overwhelmed, because we're just trying to fulfill all these needs. Mm. And sometimes it's okay to put the brakes on and say, no, can't do that, won't do that, not good to do that, and so forth. And if it's done in a right way, in a compassionate, loving, kind way, it'll be received, you know, and so forth. I don't want to get burnt out, you know, on this path, you know. I found my fit, and I just slow it down, you know, and I enjoy the ride, enjoy the experience, and so forth. And I try not to get myself in those situations where I feel overwhelmed.
Right. Yeah, and I appreciate what you said, Andre, because I think it really does speak to the fact that we all have to acknowledge that this is a process of moving in that direction, and we have to be willing to accept the limits that we do feel at any particular time, that are, and particularly when we're not going to help the other person really by saying yes, by going along with everyone else, just because frequently that's driven more by us wanting to please others than it is by our really genuine concern for them. So, yeah, it becomes distorted at that level. Nonetheless, I mean, we can still say that these incredible beings, there's a wonderful story of the Buddha when he was a bodhisattva. Again, how literal these stories are, I can't say, but it exemplifies the degree to which one could embody compassion towards other beings. There's the story that many of you have heard. It's in the Golden Light Sutra, where the Buddha is this prince who's out with his brothers, and he comes across a tigress who's starving. There's been a drought, and so there's no nourishment for the tigress, and she's just had 5 cubs. These cubs are going to die. The tigress is going to die. And the Bodhisattva prince, who later became the Buddha, says, I've been practicing so many eons to be able to give my body to another being out of compassion for the suffering that that tigress was experiencing and the death of the cubs that would ensue. I'm going to give my body now. And, you know, cuts open his own neck and starts feeding the tigress, and the tigress eats him, and they all live. And they become like the Buddha's disciples. You know, the 5 cubs become like the 5 initial disciples of the Buddha at Deer Park. You know, that sounds pretty outrageous. And do any of us have the compassion to do that at this moment? And is that being taken advantage of or being used? I mean, it would depend upon your perspective. The perspective of the Bodhisattva prince was, this is what I've been praying for. This is the perfect opportunity for me to do that level of benefit to others. But are we there yet? No. I mean, so I agree with what you say, and yet acknowledge that there are levels that you can go to, and Rinpoche even talks about this frequently, that bodhisattvas want to be used by others. Why? Because that's kind of what gets them off. That's what we're bodhisattvas are about. That's what we are trying to do, is to be of use to others, to be a benefit to others. And that's a pretty outrageous example, and I'm not expecting any of us in the room to go out and practice it. You know, in New Mexico, there's, you know, occasional mountain lions and things. I wouldn't go, like, hiking in the woods and see a mountain lion with cubs and go, oh, great. You know, I'm not there yet. It's just not going to happen right now. But that's, I still have to acknowledge that I have the potential to get there, to be so selfless and so totally okay with benefiting other beings to that degree, not having any of that attachment to even this body, that I would willingly give it. I can see that as a possibility. Not there yet, though.
Yeah, Shantideva said, right, Shantideva said, I've already given my body, so what does it matter what you do with it?
Right,
know?
Exactly.
You know, and so forth. So I think that's the whole idea. It's like, I'm willingly being compassionate. Mm-hmm. So if you take advantage of me, that's on you. You know, right. That's not on me, because right. I'm willingly doing this for you, knowing right. that you could do that. Yeah.
And you know, and there's always kind of these both sides to it, because there's the other story of the when he was a bodhisattva ship captain, and he actually took the life of somebody who was going to kill the other 499 people, the merchants on the ship. So, you know, out of his compassion for both who was going to be killed and the person who was going to do that killing, he decided to actually take a life in that situation. So once more, it requires some wisdom to know what is the right thing to do at any particular time. And if we're only going to create more misery and problems and difficulties for others through our acts, well, then that's not so beneficial. If we're going to actually help them in ways that are genuine, that will allow us to progress spiritually, be better capable to benefit them and help them in the moment, then how wonderful. You know, so it's a complicated path. You know, we can't just take it at face value, black and white. Everything is exactly the way it's supposed to be. We always have to apply where we are at that particular time. And the initial part of the path is saying, okay, I just need to take care of myself. That's what the first 2 levels of the stages of the path, the Lam Rim, are built on, is I need to attend to my own suffering. And many of us want to jump right to, you know, oh, I want to have compassion for all beings. But if you don't really spend the time looking at your own suffering and examining it, your compassion is going to be faulty. So start there. Be somewhat selfish in your own point of view of looking at what needs to be addressed for yourself. And then apply that same understanding for every other being. So once more, that's why we go through this gradual progression, is because we're not ready to enter right at university level. We need to, you know, do all the work that precedes that. So, Any other comments? Thanks for these. Yes.
I want to continue what you're saying because this is extremely helpful for me. I've been really, really struggling with an issue for years, and I recently tried to ask about it and actually even asked the question, and everyone answered, I guess I didn't word it right, because everyone answered it in terms of, this. It's not exactly compassion in my case, but I won't bore everyone with it. You know, how do you know when, you know, it's your compassion, at what point is it no longer good for the person that you're giving it to? But I was wondering about myself. I mean, because I have a hard time knowing. I'm not very self-aware, and I don't know how, at what point where it's becoming hurtful to me. That the compassion that I'm giving out, because I don't realize it until I'm burnt out. The situation that I mean, I have an issue with. I feel awful because I'm in debt and can't give to the center and to teachers and stuff. And every time that I'm at a retreat and you making up your envelopes, I struggle. Can I afford $25 or $35? And it was different when we didn't have credit cards, you know, and we had this much money and that was it. But now when you're in debt and you're just like, I get so upset. I feel guilty when every time they bring up about giving money, I just feel awful, and I don't know I give some, but I don't know at what point I'm actually damaging myself. You know, I can't find that line. So I see now, and no one ever understood this question. They always took it to mean worrying about whether the hobo you're giving money to is going to spend it on booze or something. But it was more about, I can't figure it out. And so this is kind of like the compassion, knowing where to stop, but in terms of your own health. And this is the closest that any teaching has come to addressing this issue with me, although it's about compassion instead. But I don't know. But it was helpful, yeah. Somewhat, but I still don't know my limits. But thank you.
Well, and I think that this is something, again, you'll hear different teachings at different levels of the path. Once more, the willingness to give everything away is only being practiced by those who have that ability. You know, it should only be practiced by those who have that ability. In fact, this story I just related about the Buddha giving his body when he was the Bodhisattva prince, well, that's, they caution you, that is not a teaching that we should take to heart and like go out and feel like we can immediately do that. I'm going to give all my organs to all the people who need them and, you know, kill ourselves because we want to be generous to others. That's not an appropriate way to interpret this, because most of us are not at that level. I'd say, maybe give a kidney, give some bone marrow, give whatever, give some blood. A lot of people gave blood yesterday. We can rejoice, you know. So there's lots of things that we can do that can fit into our capability, and we should just keep nudging that up till we become more and more capable. And generosity is an example, too, where we can be moved by the suffering of others. This is one of the compassion leads to a lot of these practices, to generosity, because if we have compassionate concern, then we will care about those who are in need to what degree that we can give. But we have to balance that with what do we need for our own survival to some degree. And many teachers will say that.
It's hard to know. I mean, 2 weeks ago I gave $7 to a person on the street, but
right.
Now I have $40 in my bank account and you can grocery
shopping. And just as a side point on this, because we need to get back to compassion, but generosity is definitely one of the things that springs from compassion. First of all, we need to be really clear about always our motivation in giving, you know, that makes sure that we're as genuinely in touch with bodhicitta, with our desire to benefit others, and not have it have any sort of mind that will taint it in terms of, because some people give out of pride. Some people give out of pity. Some people give out of, you know, whatever, different delusions. But the other thing is then to also have this trust that all of our acts of generosity have their effects in time. I had one teacher who told me if we had absolute conviction in the karma of giving, we would give it all away right now because we'd have complete faith and trust that would all come back to us. I'm not there yet. Sorry, you know. I don't like go emptying my bank accounts and give them to everybody and just hope that, you know, my bank accounts are going to fill again. I just don't have that level of conviction yet. I honestly say that. And I think we all are working towards having that ability. There was a nun who worked in the office up in Taos. My current partner was working in the office at the time, and he would occasionally give money to her. And he like see her, you know, he'd go, "Oh, you don't have any money. Let me give you something." He'd give her $20, and then he'd see her turn around and giving it to Liberation Prison Project or some other thing, you know. And he'd be like really upset, like, "Why did she give this away?" And I was like, "Oh, it's just she's just really practicing the cycle of generosity. That you know, when you receive, then you're happily giving." Pretty advanced practitioner in my mind. But we can see it and go almost call it foolish because somebody is taking that and just channeling it elsewhere. So everyone's going to practice at their own level is the point I'm making. I'm not saying you should be like the nun or you should be like the Bodhisattva prince or you should be like any of these. You should be like Christine.
I need to find out what Christine is. I think I need to be an accountant.
And the one thing to understand is that it doesn't mean that we have to give physical resources either. Our compassion frequently can call upon us to give in other ways. Even just to give loving kindness to others is one of the ways of giving. In the moment, just to send that out and say, you know, you may see a homeless person that you don't have the resources to benefit at the moment. Sorry, no money in my pocket. But you can wish them well in your thoughts, you know. Or you can just say, you know, "I can't give you any money, but I have a few minutes if you'd like to sit down and talk." I mean, my gosh, homeless people, they need somebody to identify them as just a valid person on the street sometimes rather than, you know, turning away and wanting nothing to do with them. You know, just do whatever. Yeah, I mean, there's so many ways that you can give. So don't think that you have to have resources. This is what Master Shantideva says in one of his texts. It's like, you know, those without resources, you find other ways to give. So anyway, compassion is the root of all of this.
I want to quote Venerable Robina. She would say, "You know, darling," she says, as she called everybody darling, "dear, you can't help others, you can't even help yourselves at this time." So.
Yeah, exactly. No, we have to be okay acknowledging that. So, let's see. Did we even read through what's in page 3? Did I read that? I think I did. Did I read that? No, that's okay. I'm just trying to wrap things up. We only have a few more minutes. I read the quote. Okay, so what we'll do tomorrow is a little different because we will have folks coming in for the Sunday teaching, but I think they'll all appreciate a nice little meditation on compassion. What I would like you to do as homework, if possible, is just to kind of read through what's there for a measurable compassion for the meditation, and we'll do a portion of that at least tomorrow morning. You'll notice that there's another addendum that's referred to there, and that's on page 4 is the reference to the addendum. Addendum 2, points for meditation on the suffering of sentient beings. It's on pages 9 and 10. And this is just a little glossary of kind of the various sufferings that the Buddha set out. It's more of a list than a glossary. The first three, there's a for the three types of suffering, I'll talk about these a bit more tomorrow, but I think most of us in the room have heard that teaching, that this is like the way that the Buddha initially kind of set out what our situation is that we're all in what's called the state of dukkha. Dukkha is a Sanskrit word that essentially means dissatisfaction, or we translate it as suffering. But it's not just the gross form of suffering, and that's what's on the bottom of page 9 is what we call suffering of suffering or suffering of pain. And those experiences that we clearly identify as such. Then we go to the top of page 10, we see that the Buddha went on to say that there's also what we call the dukkha of change, which is the fact that even those pleasant experiences that we have aren't capable of satisfying. Remember I was explaining earlier today how temporal happiness, the happiness that we can wish for others that is in the moment, isn't going to ultimately satisfy. In fact, it is a form of dukkha. Now, does that mean that we're wishing for others to suffer when we want them to have temporal happiness? Well, not really. I mean, we want them to have a level of comfort so that they can use their life meaningfully, so that they can actually do something purposefully with that. We don't want them to have, you know, millions and millions of dollars and what have you, and then just get more greed and desire and avarice and what have you. So it's important that we recognize that all of those transitory experiences of pleasantness are just that. They don't last, and they don't provide any long-term satisfaction or freedom from our problems. I sometimes point out how, like, you know, could bring in. Venerable Rabina always likes chocolate cake, right? So, and many of you like chocolate cake. Maybe some of you don't like chocolate cake. And if so, then you can substitute whatever cake you like or pie or whatever. But if I were to bring in a chocolate cake and say, oh, you know, Linda, would you like a piece of chocolate cake? And Linda could say, no, thank you. I'm still experiencing the pleasure from the first piece of chocolate cake I had. Well, then it would be different, right? Then we would have an experience of pleasure that lasted and that fully satisfied and that doesn't require another piece of cake in order for it to happen. But we know that's not the case. We just keep going back to these pleasures again and again and again because we have the illusion that they're helping us to be happy. Happy in the moment, but they don't lead to any real lasting satisfaction. And in fact, if we were to, you know, continue to eat chocolate cake, for example, it doesn't make you happier. You know, piece after piece after piece, you're not all blissed out. You're actually, you know, about ready to throw up. So we know that these aren't real experiences of happiness. Therefore, they are the suffering of change. Pervasive conditioned suffering is the fact that we are in this state of samsara that is conditioned by our karma and delusions. We frequently use the idea that it's worded there. We're under the control of our karma and delusions. This is the 24/7 suffering. This is the fact that no matter what we do, no matter where we go, it pervades all of our experiences and all of samsara, whatever existence you have, you're in a state of suffering. It's like you're in prison all the time. You know, we have to really get that and understand that level of suffering for ourselves and for others to have that full compassion. Otherwise, we only have compassion when people have the suffering of suffering, you know, when beings are experiencing that type of pain or anguish. And we don't have compassion otherwise. So we have to work with these. Again, I just listed the other ones, the six types, the eight types, the specific sufferings of the various realms, which Rinpoche emphasizes frequently. And I gave you some footnotes for Liberation in the Palm of Your Hand, where you can go and find more teachings on those various types of suffering. I won't have time to go into all of those, but it's important that we recognize the varieties of suffering that beings are going through and the extent to which it encompasses their whole experience in samsara. Then our compassion will be quite complete and genuine because we're not just, again, contingent upon grosser forms of suffering to generate that mind. So if you could just read through those, again, just get familiar with it. Any questions or comments about compassion? I'll talk a bit more about compassion tomorrow. I don't think I'm quite done with it, but anyone? Wow, you guys have been so attentive today. This has been great. I've enjoyed this a lot. So, yes, Anna.
Is compassion the same as bodhicitta?
So, Anna's question is, compassion the same as bodhicitta? They sometimes sound like they're equated, but we can actually say that compassion is what precedes bodhicitta, and bodhicitta is a bigger idea than just compassion. It is motivated by compassion as well as love, loving kindness. But it's the bigger thought of wanting to relieve the suffering of others and place them in happiness by becoming a Buddha oneself.
Yeah.
Right. It includes that additional aspiration, wanting to achieve the welfare of others, which again is placing them in happiness, freeing them from suffering by becoming a Buddha oneself. So we need to have that accompanying thought. Otherwise, I mean, we could have this kind of just general thought that we'd like to do that, but if we don't subscribe and sign ourselves up for the whole bodhisattva path and our attainment of Buddhahood, we're kind of missing the means of being able to accomplish that. I'll talk about this tomorrow afternoon. Absolutely. The analogy I frequently use for that, and I may repeat this tomorrow depending on who's all here, is if you were really, say there's a young girl who has many people in her family who develop cancer. And so she becomes very moved as a young girl to become an oncologist, to actually help people with cancer. Well, let's say she starts off with saying, oh, I would really like to be able to help all these people with cancer. Look at how these family members of mine have suffered. Well, if it just stops there and she has this wish to benefit others, but she never does anything to become qualified to help people with cancer, there's not a lot of point to it. I mean, it's wonderful, great that she has that thought, but will it actually do anything to alleviate the suffering of those with cancer? No. Whereas if she accompanies that thought of I want to benefit people with cancer by becoming an oncologist, by training myself through medicine to be able to benefit others in that way, then it's so much more powerful, right? then she's actually becoming qualified to be able to do the work of alleviating the suffering of cancer.
And so that's
bodhicitta. Bodhicitta is when we talk about the suffering of all beings, and you want to become a Buddha so you can alleviate their suffering and place them in bliss and happiness. So it's going beyond even cancer, but the cancer analogy is one way of looking at it, you know, where we can have a very compassionate motivation, a very strong motivation, but if we don't accompany it with the means to be able to affect that, then it's kind of not complete.
Right there I was reading
it. Yeah.
But the chitta is the pure, holy mind and heart.
Yeah. So bodhicitta, we could say, describe it that way, the pure, holy mind and heart. It's the mind of awakening. It has those two aspirations, to benefit others, and Rinpoche emphasizes that's the main one, that we really want to be able to benefit others, and the secondary aspiration of, therefore, I need to become a Buddha. That's what Lama Yeshe was saying in that quote I said earlier, that essentially we need to be more capable of benefiting others. We need to be able to accomplish that.
If you do that, help yourself.
And this is the thing, is, yeah, as you're saying, Anna, this is the fulfillment of your own potential too, you know.
Oh, it's like a mirror, isn't it, the bodhicitta,
yeah.
So
yeah.
It just reflects right back on us. It's amazing.
I agree. I mean, this is where, once more, it goes back to what I said earlier, that His Holiness says it's being wisely selfish. How we actually take care of ourselves best is
by
being dedicated to helping others.
Or at least don't harm others.
I think that's a good place to start, you know, to just say, okay, I'm going to stop harming them. And then I'm going to eventually get to a place where I want to help them to the greatest degree. Not just to relieve cancer, not just to help those who are need resources, not just to help those who are starving, but rather to bring all sentient beings out of their state of suffering, out of samsara, into Buddhahood.
So then when you achieve that holy mind and heart, you are a bodhisattva. I mean, you are a Buddha.
Well, we would say you are a bodhisattva.
A bodhisattva.
Yeah.
Oh.
Because then you are on the path that is going to develop your mind fully. It's kind of like when this young girl decides she wants to become an oncologist, then she dedicates herself very strongly to those courses and that plan that will get her through medical college and all the way to becoming a qualified oncologist and then benefiting others. So bodhicitta is like the mind that says, okay, I'm going to benefit others to this degree. Therefore, I'm going to dedicate myself to the path. Therefore, one becomes a bodhisattva by virtue of that. And I'll talk about this tomorrow in terms of the strength of mind of bodhicitta that we need to be technically a bodhisattva, to get your little bodhisattva card, you know, with a little picture of you.
Because the lamas say that without bodhicitta, baby, forget about enlightenment.
Well, exactly. It precedes enlightenment. And we would say compassion precedes bodhicitta. Because the original question of compassion versus bodhicitta, we have to have this deeper compassion before we can generate bodhicitta.
Because the bodhicitta comes from bodhisattvas, and the bodhisattvas come from sentient beings, and so it just goes on and on. It's interesting.
Yeah.
Thank
you. Good. Yes, Andre, if you could just pass it up there, yeah.
Oh.
This one is, because I'm...
Those of you who need to leave, it's 4 o'clock already, 4:07 or 8 or something like that. I'm just going to answer one more question, and then we'll wrap up for today. But if you need to leave, that's fine.
And you don't have to answer this one, this is too much. The immeasurable, mm-hmm. We talked about what immeasurables mean.
Right.
I don't know if that's similar to paramitas. I'm not quite sure about the definition of paramita. I wouldn't ask this question.
A paramita is usually defined as a perfection, and by that we mean kind of the perfected state. And immeasurable is maybe, again, something that is also perfected in that state of Buddhahood, but is a little bit different, I think. Yeah. Okay, so let's wrap up things. Let's go to page 235 of the prayer book. And on page 235, we're just going to recite these first two prayers. dedicating all the positive potential we've created through everything that we've done here today, all the thoughts we've had, all the words that we've heard or shared ourselves, all of this for the complete enlightenment of ourselves and others. And in the second verse, we've been talking already about bodhicitta and meditating on this as our motivation. But we want to make that strong aspiration that that mind continue to deepen and grow in our own hearts and in the hearts of others. Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel bodhicitta that has not arisen arise and grow, and may that which has arisen not diminish but increase more and more. Then turn the page on 237 at the bottom. Rather than doing the individual prayers for our teachers, let's bring to mind His Holiness, Khenpa Rinpoche, Lama Zopa Rinpoche, Geshe Gelug, all the other teachers that we and others have as guides. And through this prayer, may we make prayers for their good health and their long lives, and also for all beings to benefit from them. It's the one at the bottom of page 237. May the glorious Guru's lives be long and stable. May all beings equaling the extent of space have happiness. May I and others without exception accumulate merit and purify negativities. And may we be blessed to quickly attain Buddhahood. Okay, thank you all very much. I'll see you. Tomorrow is at 10:30, I think, right? We start at 10:30, go till noon, and then there's a break for lunch. Okay. Good. Have a good evening.